up, everybody? Welcome back to the Good Theology Podcast. My name is Jake. I am here with my co-host, David Campbell, and of course, our producer, Josh Garcia. What's up, boys? How are you?
Doing good.
Yeah?
It's a new year. First recording of the new year.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to everyone.
We made it. David, did you make it?
Did. Yeah. Well, it looks like it. I'm still on the right side of the grass, so.
What does that mean?
That's some Canadian expression we don't know about.
Josh will explain it to you.
Yeah, that's simple-minded folk. We don't
understand that. Cool.
Well, it's good to be back together. We are kicking off a new book for the next several weeks of this podcast that I'm super excited to talk through. And it's called Sermon on the Mount and Human Flourishing. And it's by an author named Jonathan Pennington, who I believe is a professor at Southern Seminary. I'm stoked on this discussion because it's going to coincide with a sermon series that we'll do here at our church in LA and Nashville. At the very least, I'm going to find these conversations helpful for
sermon prep.
For my sermon prep.
There you go.
Which is great. This is basically my sermon preparation strategy. I just.
You run ideas through this podcast.
Yes.
There you go.
Exactly. So I've got AI running in the background that's recording everything David says, and then it just turns it into a sermon for me.
Is that what Pulpit AI is about?
That's exactly what it's about. Yeah.
You better watch what I'm saying.
What did you say, David?
I better watch what I'm saying then.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so I guess I'll just simply set this book up. Full disclosure, I already read it. And so we're starting today, I think, with chapters 1 to 4. So I don't have those super fresh in my head. So
okay.
As always, I'm going to be leaning on David.
There you go.
Filling a lot of the gaps. But setting it up really simply. Straight from the mouth of the author here, or the pen of the author, he says, the argument of this book is that the sermon, that is the Sermon on the Mount, is Christianity's answer to the greatest metaphysical question that humanity has always faced. How can we experience true human flourishing? So he's saying that the Sermon on the Mount is Christianity's answer to the question that everybody across the ages has been asking, is that how we as humans can flourish, or perhaps how can we be truly happy? And so he's going to spend several chapters setting up how to read the sermon,
right?
And then he's going to actually provide a commentary on the entirety of the sermon in the next section of the book. And his paradigm is that the sermon is Jesus answering that question of how can we actually be flourishing in life. And then just one more little quote here. He says, the argument of this book will be that the sermon's answer to the human flourishing question is that true human flourishing is only available through communion with the Father God through his revealed Son Jesus as we are empowered by the Holy Spirit. That sounds like basic Christianity. But he then goes on to say that this flourishing is only experienced through faithful, heart deep, whole person discipleship, following Jesus's teachings and life, which situate the disciple into God's community or kingdom. Which I guess is another way of saying, like, we can't experience true human flourishing by just taking God's grace for granted and living however we want and expect that because we believe in Jesus, our lives are going to flourish. You know, just because God showers right. blessings upon us.
There's specific instructions to follow.
It does actually require us to, his words here, engage in heart deep, whole person discipleship. And he's going to go on to talk about where he gets that kind of language from and how that equals us truly living lives that are, in an inverted sense from the world's way of doing things, flourishing. David, opening thoughts from you.
Yeah, I don't have the advantage you've had in that I haven't read the whole book. I've only read the first part of it. And the way that he sets it up he spends quite a bit of time, almost, I don't know, maybe half of the book, in talking about some of the background to the Sermon on the Mount, and then the latter half is the actual exposition. So I haven't even got into the exposition. But it's interesting. He walks a kind of a fine line because he's trying to say that this is a way of human flourishing. And he uses that to translate where Jesus says, blessed are the meek, for instance, or blessed are the poor in heart, blessed are the merciful, and so on. He translates that word, which in Greek is makarios. He translates that as flourishing. And it could go really badly wrong. If, for instance, it could go into, oh, somebody wrote, you know, that book called Your Best Life Now, for instance. And then there was another author who I think was really a good Bible teacher, but his reduction of the Beatitudes was the Be Happy Attitudes, which isn't a sermon I would have preached, but anyway. And no doubt it was quite sound when he got into it. I never read it, but it's just the reduction is Christianity is the way to, you know, it's like a self-help motivational, you know, you'll be happy if you follow these guidelines and so on. And he realizes that danger and he's saying, that's not the way that I want to go. But he's trying to say that Jesus does offer us a lifestyle, I guess I could use that word, a flourishing lifestyle, if we are obedient to him and follow him in the path of discipleship, as is laid out in the Sermon on the Mount. But of course, even in saying that, we have to understand that the call to carry the cross and to suffer is part of that flourishing lifestyle. And I'm sure when he gets into it, he includes that in it.
Yep.
But he wants to kind of broaden out the Sermon on the Mount from the idea of blessed are the poor in heart, being God is speaking a blessing on them, but he's not really doing anything else for them, into he's broadening that out into a statement that the blessing of God comes with benefits attached to it. I think that's the way that I would phrase it.
Yeah.
So it took me a while to kind of get into what he was saying. And I don't know, Jake, if you had that kind of take on it or a bit different.
No, for sure. And I want to backtrack for in a second to talk a little bit more about some of the cultural background to the Sermon on the Mount. But to just pick up on this thread that you're talking about now, a huge foundational element to his interpretation of the sermon is his understanding of the word makarios, which from my understanding, he's just one in a really large camp of Bible scholars who say the English word blessed does not carry the right connotations any longer in order for us to really understand what Jesus is saying in the Beatitudes. So it would be common to hear something like, well, a good English translation for blessed is happy, which is, I guess, why that person had the Be Happy Attitudes. Because the Old Testament background, from the Septuagint standpoint, and I think even in the Hebrew, and I don't speak Hebrew or Greek, so I will definitely get something about this wrong. But the point that he makes is the words that are translated into blessed are not in the sense of how we think, like a superior putting a blessing upon an inferior, like a king blessing a subject or God blessing a human. It's not that word. The word rather is having more to do with a way of being in the world that results in blessing, that results in flourishing, that results in happiness. Now, he's going to talk a lot about how in the kingdom of God, it's very inverted. So it's not just about I'm well-to-do all the time. It very much is blessed are the poor in spirit, you know, and blessed are you when you are persecuted for righteousness' sake. So he's not trying to make the Beatitudes or the rest of the sermon say something that it's not, but he is saying that this is Jesus's teaching for here's what it looks like to be truly happy, to truly flourish in life. And it is an upside down kingdom. But I did find that really helpful for him to break down the word itself and to get some of that background in terms of our current English word blessed does not incite in our minds the correct pictures for what it would have incited in the minds of the original hearer. That's what I got from it.
Yeah, that's what he's saying. And of course, the difficulty is how do you find an alternative? Because any alternative that you find, for instance, if you use the word happy, that would not be what Jesus was aiming at.
Right.
So he's fixed on this word flourishing, which would be one alternative. But it's the task of the good exegetical teacher, that is a Bible teacher who goes through the text of Scripture and explains what it means, is to be able to take these words, and often it's better to, you know, how shall I put it? Our job is to take the word and explain what it means. And often, quite often, it's exactly what it means. Mm-hmm. There's no ambiguity about it. We can understand that. But every so often a word comes along, and no matter what translation you put on it, someone will misinterpret it. And that's mm-hmm. where the job of the Bible teacher comes in, is to try to explain as best he can what Jesus is actually talking about here. And if you go through an extended, and I would say that where he's going is, and I think where Jesus is going is, that if you follow my teaching, you know, elsewhere he said the truth will set you free. It's mm-hmm. another way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. If you follow my teaching, you will have a life that is full of inner peace. The Hebrew word is shalom. That's mm-hmm. an important word, because it does refer to a sense of the peace of God coming into all parts of our lives. So flourishing cannot be interpreted as, well, I've got a successful thing going here. Mm-hmm. If you use that word, it's got to be, I am experiencing the daily or regular input of God into my life, which is bringing me healing and wholeness and peace.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In regardless of what my external circumstances are. And I think that's getting close to what Jesus is talking about in the Sermon mm-hmm. on the Mount.
Yep.
So
that's exactly what he's on about. And I actually really like the word flourishing. I think I'm going to do a series on the Sermon on the Mount, and I'm going to use this book as a resource for it. I was going to call it Abundant Life, because I think that's another way of describing what it is that living in the way of Jesus is it leads to abundant life, and that abundant life is inverted in a lot of ways from the world's definition of abundance. And I think he's doing the same thing here with flourishing. I think that's a way more compelling word. So I'm going to call it flourishing. I think it's really compelling. And he gives an example from Psalm 1, where it says, blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked. And that word blessed in the Hebrew is A-S-R-E. I have no idea how to pronounce that.
Well, it's the Hebrew word is asher.
Yep.
In the singular, and Ashrei that he quotes, that he cites, is a form of, well, we don't want to get into Hebrew grammar here, but it's mm-hmm. a form of the basic word. So Asher, the Hebrew word, means it's more or less, I think, the equivalent, because Jesus was speaking Hebrew or Aramaic, we're not sure which, not Greek. So he probably was using this word Asher. You know, how we find that out is there's a word in the Hebrew, and then the Septuagint was the Greek translation of the Old Testament.
Right.
And it was, it predates, it was done over a period of years prior to the time of Christ. So it's very ancient. And the value of the Septuagint is that you can see how when these people were speaking both Hebrew and Greek and Aramaic, for that matter, how they translated the Hebrew word into the Greek word. And that helps us when we come to the Old to the New Testament, where we're guessing what did Jesus actually say. In what was he speaking in Hebrew underneath this? And it's kind of a complicated way of explaining it. But the Septuagint is a bridge that explains that to us. And then it takes us back to the Old Testament, which is the, you know, the Hebraic mindset that the New Testament is birthed in. It's a product of Jewish civilization, if you want to put it that way. And their understanding of God, that this is what Jesus was talking about. Same kind of thing as the psalmist was talking about. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly.
Right. Yes. Forgive it's me, less about the bestowal of divine favor and more about experiencing the outcome of being in the world the way God commands us to be in the world.
Well, I think his concern is that the word blessed, which would go back to Elizabethan English and the Authorized Version, 1611. His concern is that it has come to mean, you know, God pronouncing something upon someone, you're blessed, let's say.
Yes.
But it's lost the part of the word that means as a result of the blessing of God, there are certain things that are going to happen in your life. Mm-hmm. But it's also lost the part of it that it's lost the part of it that it isn't just that God magically conveys a blessing and says, Jake, you're blessed. Now, all of a sudden, you know, everything you do will turn to gold. It's that God offers a way of blessing. If you want to live under my blessing, under my shalom, under my wholeness of life or flourishing, if you want to use the word, then this is how you need to live. But what differentiates it from just being a self-help thing is, by the way, you can't live that way
without the covenant relationship,
the grace of God and the help of the Holy Spirit, because you haven't got the capacity to do it. None of us do have the capacity to do it.
Yep. Right. And I think he sets it up that way really well at the beginning when he says, the goal of this book is to help you understand that the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus' answer to the question of human flourishing. And the way that it teaches us that is first and foremost that covenant relationship. Right. And then out of that covenant relationship comes this wholehearted, whole person discipleship.
So I just want to take the time to clarify that, that we're all on the same page that by blessed, it's not about a blessing being bestowed or given as a result of doing X, Y, Z, according to the Sermon on the Mount, but instead, at least the way I understood it, it's a statement of fact that by doing this, this is the natural result, but you can only attain that natural result then if you are in a covenantal relationship with God.
He's not trying to separate it, you know, from, he's not trying to just make the Sermon on the Mount a sermon about principles by which to live.
Right.
And if you do this, you're going to be guaranteed certain outcomes.
Yeah.
Any reading of the Sermon on the Mount, would realize that that's not what Jesus is talking about at all because of the actual content that makes up the sermon.
Right.
It has nothing to do with put into practice these principles and, you know, you're going to be flying high.
Right.
And, you know, it's not that.
Yeah.
It's, you're going to be experiencing true flourishing by living in a particular kind of way. But the only way that that kind of living really comes to life is through relationship with God, who embodies that way of being in the first place.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like Jesus is the personification of the Sermon on the Mount.
Of each and of those. Yeah. Everything
I did not come to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill it. Yeah. And he does that in his own being. And so we, by following him, live the same kind of way And as a result, we're blessed.
Right.
And that word blessing, according to Pennington, and I'm convinced by it, is it's really not, hey, you do this, and as a disassociated response, I'm going to place a blessing on you.
Right.
It is come into this way of being that is the true way to live, yeah. And in that you will experience the blessing. It's almost kind of like is it Psalm 133, where God commands the blessing of life, where people dwell in unity. It's like those unity brings the blessing, because yeah. That's the way God has set it up. I guess that would be a way that I would understand it. Living this kind of way brings the blessing because God has determined that this is what it really means to flourish in
right. life.
Yeah. David, I don't know if you'd clear anything up from that.
Well, I think it's Jesus inviting us into a relationship with him where our lives can be truly transformed. And I think that it does speak something into our culture, in the sense that our culture is as much or more perhaps than any culture in human history. I'm talking about our Western culture, is hooked on self-improvement mm-hmm. or techniques to make yourself happier in one way or another. Do this, you know, even you know, in our diet, do this and you'll have good physical health, let's say. And I think that the Bible is not the message. I'm sorry, the gospel is not simply, the gospel is foundationally the message that you are lost and here's a way out of your lostness. It's been paid for by the blood of Christ, and so on. That is the foundation of the gospel. But the gospel is also, when Jesus preached the gospel, going back to Isaiah 61, what the messenger of good news in Isaiah, which was the gospel, in the Hebrew word, is that's the background of the word gospel. The message of the gospel was the healing of the sick and the coming of the kingdom. And it wasn't just that background noise is my snowplow, our snowplow going past, which is a sign that we're not living in the flourishing of Los Angeles, where it's all nice and concrete. Anyways, the gospel is, you know, the healing of the sick and healing in a holistic sense and the coming of the kingdom. And that's what we have to offer. We're not just, we are offering personal, you know, salvation from hell, but we're also offering entrance into the kingdom of heaven, which right. is a theme in the Sermon on the Mount.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. I think that if we can focus as churches our presentation of the gospel to and broaden it out to everything the gospel involves, it's profoundly attractive to people who are already looking for, they're programmed to look for a way. They're looking for, what can I do to make life better? Well, we've got the answer. You mm-hmm. know, we're not going to reduce it to, you know, eat blueberries all your life and you'll never have colon problems or something. We're not reducing the gospel to that. But I mean, we're saying, hey, you know, we really have something that is going to put your life in order.
Right.
Just to clarify, if I do the blueberry thing, is that
good? Is that actually
does that help or?
Well, I don't know. It depends who you listen to.
There you go.
At the end of the message, it's always somebody selling a product. So
I'll just say one more thing. I think that kind of helps drive this difference home. So he does say that there's another Hebrew word besides Ashrei, that's translated into blessed, and it's the Hebrew root BRK. And that occurs, okay, hundreds of times throughout the Old Testament. And that and its counterpart has to do with blessings and cursings. Mm. But that is different from Ashrei, or the Greek Makarios, which is typically translated as blessed, but right. it's used in the Old Testament in an entirely different sense. So you might find Barak in in like the covenant at Sinai, where God is saying blessing and cursing.
Right.
But in Psalm 1, it's a totally different Ashrei, yeah, is a different idea that's being communicated there.
I think I've got a question
It's the blessing and the result of the blessing. The when God baraks someone, blesses someone, then the result of that is the person is Asher. Their life is changed as a result. They're in, you know, the state of flourishing, to use that word. So the blessing which comes upon us is the gospel. When we accept Christ, God places his blessing upon us, but it's a doorway to a life of
covenant peace. Faithfulness.
Right.
So, yeah, the blessing of God. It's and so, you know, there's something here where it's a tragedy where Christians live very dysfunctional lives. And C.S. Lewis put it rightly when he said, some people are starting from a very low place. Their life is in a complete mess. Other people have everything going for them. So you can't judge one person against another. But when God comes into someone's life, everybody's life should be elevated. Everybody's life should become better than it was before, so to speak. And that's what Jesus is teaching. If you are, and the key is discipleship. It's, you know, Christianity properly understood is a way of discipleship. So it's bizarre and out of order for someone to be a part of a church and professing to be a Christian, but not walking in a discipleship relationship with Christ or with other people.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's actually what I first wanted to call this series.
Discipleship?
I just wanted to call it disciple.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's really what it is.
At its core.
Yeah, its core. And being a disciple is what truly leads into a life of flourishing.
Yeah, I've got a question. I don't know if this is connected or not, but looking at the Sermon on the Mount, it does look like a bunch of, it's a list of prescriptions of things you should do or that you ought to do. Should we differentiate that from the list of things to do, say, in the Ten Commandments? Like, how different is that? Or is it the same in the sense of what, I guess, God was trying to say back then and what God was trying to say in the Sermon on the Mount? Because I just look at those things and like, okay, if I obey the Ten Commandments, then I receive God's blessing, right? So does it kind of link to that, or is it meant to be looked at a different lens?
You know, Jesus is drawing out, and we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but what he's drawing out in the Sermon on the Mount is that whole person, heart level righteousness.
Right.
What it truly means to live as a disciple. And that's where the flourishing, that's where the blessing is found. So it's not just a prescription of do this. In fact, one of his amazing insights, I think, in his exposition of the sermon itself, is when he starts talking about the theme of hypocrisy and how we often think of hypocrisy as I say one thing and do another. So there's a lack of integration between my words and my actions. And while he acknowledges that that is indeed hypocrisy, the kind of hypocrisy, however, that Jesus is talking about in the Sermon on the Mount is not saying one thing and doing another. It's doing the right thing, but your core, your inside, is completely out of whack in terms of motive,
right?
And what kind of reward it is that you're seeking after. So it's a different kind of hypocrisy. And so Jesus wants to lead us into that, and I'm forgetting the author's exact words, so maybe I keep saying it wrong, but that whole person, heart level living.
Holistic.
Yeah, that truly is what produces a flourishing life. So anyway,
yeah, and
David, say a couple things, but I don't want to go too much down that rabbit hole because we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. Go ahead.
Well, I to go back to what Josh raised a minute ago, the Sermon on the Mount is Jesus' interpretation of the Old Testament law. So of course there's a connection between the two. That's one of the things in our understanding of the New Testament that we get wrong so badly so much of the time. The Old Testament, and brought in this new, well, you just love, you know, and then you can do what you want. And that's so not what the New Testament teaches. The New Testament teaches that Christ came to fulfill the law, that love is at the very heart of the law and all its commandments. And so here in the Sermon on the Mount, what Jesus is saying is not, hey, it's time to throw the law out, to fulfill the law and the prophets. I've come here to show you how to really live out what Moses commanded you to do. And so we live in such a way that, like, you use the example of doing the right thing. The Pharisees did some of the right things. They tithed and et cetera. But because their heart was wrong, they did something externally. But if you do something externally and your heart isn't right, then your motive is wrong. And in the end, the weightier demands of the law you will not do. So Jesus said, you may tithe, but you won't really understand what it is to love your neighbor and to love the Lord your God with all your heart. All you're doing is carrying out a series of rules to get God's favor. That's a broken personality. And religion is, the religious spirit is a broken personality. It's somebody who thinks they can get God's favor by doing, you know, A, B, and C, but they're totally, but you can never get God's favor by doing A, B, and C. You can only get God's favor by saying, God, I am a sinner. I need your help. And your favor is given to me as a gift. And then once God gives his gift, then he sets us off in this path of discipleship where we can fulfill the weightier demands of the law, at least in part.
I'm going to start using that as a pastoral care tool.
Well, which one?
I'm just going to start telling people they have a broken personality.
It's a softer way of saying things. Broken personality.
We all do. The next person I have coffee with, like, man, I've been listening to you for a while, and I think what's really going on here is
you got a broken personality.
Okay, let's backtrack really quick, because I do want to get your insights on this, David. So one of the backgrounds, or I guess rather two of the backgrounds that he gives for the original audience's hearing of the Sermon on the Mount are Second Temple Judaism and the Greco-Roman virtue teaching, culture, tradition, I think. Yeah, let's go tradition. So the reason I wanted to talk to you about this is I've heard you, like, off the cuff say one or two things over the last few years, not even necessarily on this podcast, but I haven't had a chance to ever, like, talk to you about it in terms of the background to first century Judaism having the influence of the Hellenized culture and also Second Temple Judaism. Can you just talk about that, and what are your like reflections on what kind of he sets forward here as those two overlapping with one another to best understand the words that Jesus originally uses and that Matthew writes down in Greek?
I haven't read the whole book, of course, so I'm not entirely sure how he unfolds that in his exegesis of the sermon itself. But I think that the background to the New Testament is far more weighted on the Jewish side than it is in the what we call the Hellenistic. Hellene is the word for the Greek, right? So in Greek. So how the Roman Empire operated was politically and militarily, it was run from Rome by the Italians, but culturally and philosophically, it was run from Athens by the Greeks. And so the Greeks came before the Romans in terms of the development of their civilization. Obviously, it was a very sophisticated level in terms of their intellectual development. And in as well as that, Alexander the Great, when he conquered all the way from present day Greece to India, it was one of probably the most incredible military achievement in all of history, because he did it so quickly and was very young. And died when he was about your age, Jake, you know, having conquered all of that. Then through his successors, who were Greeks, the kind of Greek ideas and values and so on became disseminated throughout what is today the Near East, what we describe as the Middle East, I guess. And so there was that part of it in the couple hundred years before the time of Christ. And the Roman Empire kind of reinforced that in a sense that it brought common government to that whole area. So, but at the same time, Jesus was a Jew. He thought in Old Testament terms, so did his disciples and all of his listeners. And they lived in primarily a Judaic world, which was, which had some, you know, just like when you live in a pagan culture, some of the values seep in, but it was largely a Jewish world and a Jewish mindset. And so I think you have to be really careful when you look at the, now I think the Apostle Paul, for instance, when he's getting into the Gentile churches in Greece, what's now Greece or what's present day Turkey, which is called Asia Minor or Galatia, or, you know, the various places he wrote his letters to, were largely Gentile churches in Gentile areas. So that's where you really have to look at. He's trying to present a Judaic gospel. By Judaic, I mean coming from the Old Testament world, right, which was a world of God's revelation to humanity. He's trying to present that to people who are Greek speaking and who have been living in this Greek cultural and philosophical world and so on. So he quotes some of the Greek poets in Acts 17 and in Titus chapter 1, and he uses the famous word parousia, you know, which is the coming of the Lord. And we've gone through that eschatology, where it's actually the emperor coming to a city, and instead of the emperor taking the people and flying them off into the clouds, like the rapture teaching, the citizens escort the emperor back into the city to take over. So Paul uses, you know, when he's preaching to the Gentiles, but the gospel primarily into by Jewish men. Those three guys were Jews, and they were writing, they were thinking in Jewish and Old Testament terms. So I don't think that we have to worry about a lot of, well, did this come in from Greece or something like that? So that's my commentary on that. And I, in this book, he says, well, you know, there was Greek wisdom teaching, you know, the sage, the ideal philosopher like Plato and so on, and Aristotle. This was the philosopher king was Plato's concept. Aristotle had the concept of, I think it was arete, virtue or wisdom, you know. It's all very, you know, that God has nothing to do with it. That just is self-help, basically, and how to make yourself a better person. And I honestly don't think that that's at all what Jesus was thinking about or had any influence in Jesus at all. I think Jesus was thinking in terms of how do you enter into the blessing of God as the Old Testament defines it and as God revealed in his law. And obviously, everybody had messed up. They hadn't got, religion was just a mess in Jesus' day. And Jesus is coming and saying, this is the real meaning of the law. And I don't think Greek influence has very much at all to do with it.
Yeah, so that's, I would say, a point of departure between you and the author. Although I would say he agrees with you in the sense, I think the analogy he uses is, if the sermon is a son and it's got a Jewish mom and a Greek father, the son is definitely raised in the mother's religion. So he agrees with you in the sense that it is more influenced by the Jewish scriptures, probably even much more, but that a lot of the words that Matthew is using to record Jesus's teaching, I guess either in Hebrew or Aramaic, certainly have ties to the virtue tradition of the Greeks, in the sense, and to use an example, like Makarios or like teleos, those are the two kind of major words that he says in the sermon.
I guess, give us the framework for understanding how best to understand it.
I've got a big workup here. It's just about, I'm going to do a little, that work on the top. There. That's called the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament, which is, it was originally all written in German. And that's a standard work. Everybody has a copy of that now, you know, electronically probably. But the idea was that they took every single word of any significance in the New Testament and they trace it back. What does it represent in Hebrew in the Old Testament? What does it represent in Greek literature prior to the time of Christ or at the time of Christ and so on? Because the New Testament was written in Greek, but just because it was written in Greek doesn't mean that it was influenced by Greek thinking. They were using a Greek word. So you can take a Greek word that Plato was using, let's say, and the same word appears in the New Testament, it means something totally different. And what the genius of that, those nine volumes behind me represents is that largely what they show is that the roots of the New Testament are in the Old Testament, largely, although, you know, they're living within a world that has expanded and other influences have come in and so on. But they're basically taking Old Testament thinking and translating it through the lens of the gospel. I think that N.T. Wright, who's one of the greatest biblical scholars alive today, I don't agree with him in everything, but he's certainly a bigger name than I am. And he's very big on this, on the Judaic background of the Old Testament. There was a trend in, you know, 75 years ago or whatever in liberal scholarship, particularly in Germany, to emphasize the Greek background. And the goal of that was to really show that the New Testament was nothing to do with the Old Testament, and it came out of mystery religions and Gnosticism and stuff like this, but scholarship since then has taken us back to the biblical roots. So this is a very the word is arcane, which is a very kind of up in the clouds. You know, this is becoming an up in the clouds discussion. It's probably my fault. Which our listeners may have gone off and made themselves a milkshake or something.
I think that they enjoy it.
Yeah,
people find it helpful, and it's great to hear you expound upon that. And that was kind of my sense about in terms of your reflections on this. It's definitely worth noting that the author's certainly not going in that direction whatsoever. He definitely posits a more significant Hellenistic influence upon the thinking of the first century Jew than you are. But again, he majors on the Jewish background. I think the main point that he's making in regards to the Hellenization culture, I think more has to do with the idea of understanding what Jesus is getting at with the sermon in terms of living a flourishing life, in the sense that he truly is wanting us to step into a life of virtue, if you will, a life of, here's a phrase he uses, reflecting God's will, nature, and coming kingdom, living in alignment with God's will, nature, and coming kingdom, all of which are very Old Testament background oriented. By doing that is when we find ourselves living under the blessing of God. So I think that's his ideas, that certainly in the Greek side of things, there's the pursuit of virtue as a means of modern day terminology, self-help, to live a happy life.
And that's probably about that. That's where the commonality like starts and ends. Mm-hmm. But there is a commonality in the sense that what Jesus is getting at is indeed cultivating a certain way of living that will produce the kind of life that we actually want to experience. Right. At least that's my understanding of it. And I'd be really curious, you know, as we get into the exposition of the sermon itself, where your thoughts land on it as well.
Yeah, so, I mean,
it Jesus sounds like you make room for a little bit of Hellenistic influence.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You see, the self-help people at the time of Jesus were called Stoics, the Stoics.
Right.
And I did some study of that when I was doing classics, you know, as an undergraduate, which was 1 or 2 years ago. But it's totally different. It's as different from the Bible as Oprah Winfrey, you know.
Yes.
My wife says I don't use that because nobody under 50 understands who Oprah was, but whatever the current equivalent is of self-help. Jesus is addressing a fundamental question of human existence, which is how do you live well? And the answer that Jesus brings is radically different from what the Stoics brought, which is basically pull yourself up by your own bootstraps and anesthetize yourself to the suffering around you as best you can. And, you know, but there was no hope of God. God didn't enter into the equation for them. And Jesus is offering a much better. So in a sense, what Jesus is offering can be measured against what the Stoics had then, or what Plato offered, or 1,000 self-help books that you can go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon or whatever and buy today. Jesus is answering or addressing the same kind of questions. He's just giving a radically different answer. And the answer he's
right.
giving is in line with the revealed will and law of God in the Old Testament.
In the Old Testament. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's it. Anyway,
it could, but they're all.
But I think certainly ties in Jewish thinking.
The idea of the wise person and the fool is age old. It's fundamental to human existence, isn't it? Every culture has its
right.
own take on it, and the Greeks did.
Right.
And the words happen to be phronimos for wise and moros, from which obviously we get moros for fool. And so, but the Old Testament has that very much so. The wise and the fool. And
right.
so I'm thinking that that's the well from which Jesus is drinking. And mm-hmm. Matthew may be employing Greek words in a way that if to the extent he has perhaps Greek-speaking people or non-Jews in his audience, that they would mm-hmm. understand there'd be a point of contact between mm-hmm. what Jesus is saying and this is how they're going to understand it. But it's important mm-hmm. to note that the gospel is saying when the Bible talks about a wise man, that's not the same thing as what secular culture or philosophy is talking about a wise man. A wise man is someone that fears God, obviously.
Right.
Not someone
Absolutely.
Who has accumulated a lot of learning or who is a philosopher or whatever. So we always have to define, however you define these terms, they always have to go back to the Old Testament, to the Old Covenant,
right.
where God revealed who he was to no other people than Israel. And that's yeah. the point. And Jesus did not come to bring a new revelation. He simply came to walk out in who he was, the requirements of the covenant, the holiness of God, and so on. He exemplified it in the flesh, in his life. And so I can see how, just like the Apostle Paul tries in his letters to explain, you know, to the Greek culture, he's talking into the Greek culture. It's really, really clear when you read 1 Corinthians, for instance, he's talking about the philosopher and the sage and wisdom and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But he's redefining. He said, you've understood it as this, but I want to explain to you that this is what true wisdom is. It's to know Christ and him crucified. He's talking into the Greek culture where there were sages and wisdom, you know, that went around and for so many dollars or drachma or whatever, you know, you could go to their tutorials and pay for, just the same as it is today, really. But Paul said the real wisdom is Christ. He's the wisdom of God. Yeah, I'm not just far looking off from what I'm
kind of glossing over, but
I'm not far off.
Yeah, I think he's got really good.
That's a really good chapter. There's a lot of really important stuff in there.
So yeah,
great, cool, super exciting.
Can't wait.
Awesome. So we'll just take time to thank everybody who's
a little easier to understand. We'll bring it to a more simple.
There you go.